want to go back to Luke chapter 12 this evening. And as you're turning back to that text, I'll tell you about a story that I read about a successful businessman who was being asked by someone trying to raise money for a charity for him to donate a bunch of money. And so he listened to the case presented for this charity, and he responded to the one who was asking for his help. And he said, "Well, I understand what you're trying to do, and I can appreciate it. But are you aware that I have a lot of folks that need my financial help? Do you know, for example, that my mother needs 24-hour nursing care?" "No," came the reply. "Well, did you know my sister is struggling to raise a family of 8 on her own?" "No, we didn't know that either." "Well, did you know I have one son in a drug rehab clinic and another doing voluntary work overseas?" "No, we didn't know that either." "Well, if I don't give them a cent, what makes you think I'll give it to you?" Oh, that's a terrible example of greed. And last Sunday night, we looked at Jesus addressing this problem of covetousness or greed in the context of a younger brother asking Jesus to settle an inheritance dispute. But he pinpointed the issue when he said to that younger brother, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." This past week, I learned a description of an idea that when I read it, it made sense. And I could see it. And I think you will readily see what is being described by these words, the Diderot effect. The Diderot effect. I want to tell you what I've learned about what this is, and then see how it applies to what Jesus is addressing in this parable of the rich farmer, as he speaks to the issue of the inheritance between these brothers. Denis Diderot was a French philosopher in the 18th century. He grew up most of his life in poverty. In fact, at the age of 52, his daughter was about to get married, and he didn't have the money for a dowry. So he had a good friend who was sensitive to his situation, and his friend contacted Catherine the Great, the Emperor of Russia, and told her of Diderot's financial crisis. And what she did is she offered to buy his library, and another source said that she would even allow him to retain that library and pay him for just to keep that library intact and to keep it for her. You see, Denis Diderot was the co-founder and writer of an encyclopedia series that was the most comprehensive encyclopedia of its time. And so suddenly, Denis Diderot came into some money. She made this initial purchase for what would be the equivalent of about $50,000 in today's currency. So he goes from being in poverty to suddenly having some money. And shortly after this lucky sale, Diderot acquired a new scarlet robe. And one source that I read said this was just a fictional robe, whereas others say he was actually given this robe. But he writes about this scarlet robe and how it changed him. And that change is what is called the Diderot effect. You see, Diderot's scarlet robe was beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, that immediately he noticed how out of place it seemed, surrounded by his other possessions. Mind you, he had grown up in poverty and didn't have much, and so this scarlet robe was the finest thing that he had, and it made everything else that he had look bad. In his words, there was no more coordination, no more unity, no more beauty between his robe and the rest of his items. So the philosopher soon felt the urge to buy some new things to match the beauty of his scarlet robe. He replaced his old rug with a new one from Damascus. He decorated his home with beautiful sculptures and a better kitchen table. He bought a new mirror to place above the mantel, and his straw chair was relegated to the antechamber by a leather chair, he writes. These reactionary purchases have become known as the Diderot effect. And that idea can be couched in these terms. The Diderot effect states that obtaining a new possession often creates a spiral of consumption which leads you to acquire more new things. Again, his scarlet robe, very nice, lavish. It made his other things look bad in comparison, and so he felt compelled to buy new things to try to match his scarlet robe. Another writer states it this way: the introduction of a new possession into a consumer's existence will often result in the process of spiraling consumption. In other words, the purchase of one new item often leads to the purchase of another. And I'm thinking you're already seeing, hey, I know what this is about. As a result, we end up buying things that our previous selves never needed. Why is it that we want things that we don't really need? Let me give you some examples of this Diderot effect. James Clear writes about his experience. He says, I recently bought a new car and I ended up purchasing all sorts of additional things to go inside it. I bought a tire pressure gauge, a car charger for my cell phone, an extra umbrella, a first aid kit, a pocket knife, a flashlight, emergency blankets, and even a seatbelt cutting tool. Allow me to point out that I owned my previous car for nearly 10 years, and at no point did I feel that any of the previously mentioned items were worth purchasing. And yet, after getting my shiny new car, I find myself falling into the same consumption spiral as Diderot. Let me give you some other examples. We buy a new shirt, or ladies, a new dress, and immediately begin looking for new shoes to match. We bring home a new couch and suddenly the end tables in our living room appeared old and shabby. Are we understanding this? We purchase a new car and soon begin spending money on car washes, more expensive gasoline, or a parking pass. Or we get into a new home and use the occasion to replace our existing bedroom set with a new one. In each of these circumstances, the reality is we already owned enough shoes and end tables and bedroom furniture, and they were functioning just fine. But because something new had been introduced into our lives, we were immediately drawn into a process of spiraling consumption. And folks, when I read this, I thought, how prevalent that is in our society. Jesus didn't refer directly to the Diderot effect, but I think it pertains so readily to the teaching that he's giving. Think now about that parable of the rich farmer. He has an abundant crop, and so what does he do? He thinks, well, I've got this excess. I'll tear down my old barns and build bigger ones to house everything that I have. You see that spiraling consumption. You see the Diderot effect in the story that Jesus is telling. And life has a natural tendency to become filled with more and more stuff. We're rarely looking to downgrade, to simplify. Our natural inclination is to accumulate, to add, to upgrade, to build upon. I like what one professor said: the pressure to upgrade our stock of stuff is relentlessly unidirectional, always ascending. And in our society, can't we see the truthfulness of that statement? But isn't that what Jesus is addressing? The rich farmer who had a lot of stuff already, is now wanting to make room for more. And again, Jesus is pinpointing the problem between these brothers arguing over inheritance. He said, you need to watch out. You need to beware of greed. And in so many words, it's saying, beware of the Diderot effect. That when you get something new, it seems that you want more new stuff. And it ends up in a spiral. And you get so consumed with consumerism with the thinking that you have to have more. And more. And then we read about Solomon's search, which included a search in material things. And his conclusion was, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. But the Diderot effect is going in the opposite direction. It's that trying to quench that thirst for more by adding more and more new things. Well, how do we overcome the Diderot effect and how it could feed our greed? Here are some very practical things that I wanted to share with you about overcoming the Diderot effect. Number one, reduce exposure. Nearly every habit is initiated by a trigger or a cue, and marketers know this. That's why, and I've witnessed this, haven't you? You're watching a television program and the commercials come on and they seem louder. Am I right? Who turned up the volume here? They're trying to get our attention, and there may be advertising soap or dishwasher detergent, but yet they try to make it fanciful and use the best looking folks to advertise. Marketers know that they want to find that trigger, that cue that'll make you think, well, I've got to have that, so I need to run out and buy it. So we need to reduce exposure. It may mean doing what my dad does when a commercial comes on, he hits the mute button. Or it may mean unsubscribing to some email commercials that we get. And yes, I'm sure we all get them. It may mean calling the magazines that send you catalogs and opt out of their mailings. It may mean meeting your friends at a park rather than at the mall. But reduce exposure. The biblical principle is make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. Romans 13, verse 14. Reduce exposure. Try to tune out this idea. You got to have more and more to be happy. Also, number two, buy items that fit your current system. Buy items that fit your current system. You don't have to start from scratch each time you buy something new. When you purchase new clothes, why not purchase things that will work well with your current wardrobe? My family would tell you about me, all David has to do is buy some more plaid. That's what he likes, and it matches most anything. When you upgrade to new electronics, get things that work nicely with your current pieces so you can avoid buying new chargers, adapters, or cables. And many of you know all about how complicated that can get. But to buy items that fit our current system, that to me is an expression of contentment. Of not having to have all things new at one time. Let your conduct be without covetousness, without greed. Hebrews 13, 5. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. You see, greed goes against contentment, doesn't it? The Diderot effect goes against contentment. How we need to learn contentment, as Paul says. Number three, set self-imposed limits. Live a carefully constrained life by creating limitations for you to operate within. That sounds a lot like setting up a budget, doesn't it? Only allow so much to go for purchasing new things. One writer says, analyze and predict the full cost of future purchases. A store may be having a great sale on an item, but if the new item compels you to buy other things to match, it just became a more expensive purchase than originally assumed. I kind of imagine this scenario. Let me just use the guy so I won't get into trouble. A guy comes in, says, I found this great deal on this suit that I can wear on Sunday morning. Well, that's wonderful, honey. How much did you spend? Well, it was a great deal. In fact, it was such a good deal, it allowed me to buy a new shirt and shoes and a new tie to go along with it. And suddenly that great deal got very expensive. Set self-imposed limits. There's a scriptural principle that Jesus gives, Luke 14:28. Which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? And he's using it to teach a spiritual principle about counting the cost of following him. But he uses an everyday situation about someone seeking to build a tower and how that person must count the cost. We must count the cost for of following Christ, yes, but even how we use the resources that God has blessed us with. So set self-imposed limits. I like this one. Buy one, give one. Number four, buy one, give one. We usually think of it in buy one, get one free. But that's not what this is saying. Buy one, give one. Each time you make a new purchase, give an old item away. Get a new TV? Well, give your old one away rather than moving it to another room. I just stepped on my own toes. Instead of accumulating, get rid of it. The idea is to prevent your number of items from growing. Always be fine-tuning your life to include only those things that you really need. But it also teaches us to be generous. Remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Acts 20, verse 35. Here's a challenge for us. Go 1 month without buying something new. If this Diderot effect, if that's painfully close to the way that we live, then let's exercise some self-control, set some limits, and let's don't buy anything new for a month. Or if we want to get a new shirt, we can go to the thrift store. But you see, the more we restrict ourselves, the more resourceful we become, and the more that we are able to exercise self-control. It's a fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5, 22 and 23. But it's also something that we must add to your knowledge, self-control, 2 Peter 1, verse 6. But now we're really getting into the issue. We need to let go of wanting things. I appreciated Brother Ken's prayer along these lines. Not getting so wrapped up in things and stuff, but recognize those things that are most valuable, like the people in our lives, like our relationship, first and foremost, with God. There'll never be a time when there won't be advertisements that you need something else. There's always something to upgrade to. But realize that wanting is an option that your mind provides, not something that you have to follow. Learn from Solomon. Listen to him, Ecclesiastes 2. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. He had the financial resources, didn't he? Whatever he desired, he got. I did not withhold my heart from pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity, all was meaningless, and a grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Solomon says, you think life is about accumulating stuff. I've done it, and I had the money to do it. But after I did it and looked upon everything that I had, I realized it's like trying to catch the wind. It doesn't satisfy. It's meaningless. It's vanity. Another suggestion is buy things for their usefulness rather than their status. Buy things for their usefulness rather than their status. How many of our purchases are made for status? Godliness with contentment is great gain. 1 Timothy 6:6. We brought nothing into this world. It is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing. And I think the Apostle Paul is saying, look at life down to its basic essentials. Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. We need to be able to differentiate between our needs and our greeds. Paul is saying, as far as your physical life is concerned, really all you need is food and clothing. With these we shall be content. Remember what is essential to life and what isn't. I like what one writer said. Stop trying to impress others with your stuff and start trying to impress them with your life. And the last suggestion, remember the most important things in life are not things. That brings us back to what Jesus said to this brother who was wanting Jesus to settle that inheritance dispute. He said, take heed and beware of covetousness. One's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses. That's not what life is about. That's not what brings life meaning, fulfillment. It's an improper goal. It's an improper measure. As Joshua Becker wrote, remind yourself that possessions do not define you. Abundance of life is not found in the abundance of things that you own. Your possessions do not define you or your success, no matter what marketers will try to tell you. So realize the most important things in life are not things at all. From time to time, I've tried to share with you something that James Dobson wrote that I've kind of adopted as a motto for my own life. And I hope that it'll be meaningful to you. I don't know if he entitled it with these words, but I entitle it, What's Important to Me. And here's what he writes. When I reach the end of my days, a moment or two from now, I must look backward on something more meaningful than the pursuit of houses and land and stocks and bonds. I will consider my earthly existence to have been wasted unless I can recall a loving family, a consistent investment in the lives of other people, and an earnest attempt to serve the God who made me. Nothing else makes much sense. That's why I've adopted that as my motto, as a reminder. It's not about stuff. It's about your family. It's about investing in other people. It's about serving the God who made us. That's what's most important. Beware of the Diderot effect. Beware of anything that causes you to misplace your emphasis on things rather than your relationship upon God and your relationship with other people, like your family. Perhaps tonight, as we've evaluated ourselves in light of, and perhaps a new phrasing of a concept that's pretty readily apparent, we do see some changes that need to be made in our lives. If you need prayers to that end, if you're ready to obey the gospel tonight, we want to assist you in that as well. If you need to respond to the invitation of Jesus, please come right now as we stand and sing.